You think this kid is drunk, Brett?
No, you are, huh?
Did Father always give you vicious little monsters for a present?
Hi, I'm Robert Lendrum.
And my name is Jamie Roberts.
And this is the Running Scared Podcast,
where we review the movies that had you running away but coming back for more. How was your weekend, Rob?
It was good. I took my son Fox to a haunted house.
Haunted house? Woohoo! Where?
So, you know, I both live in Hamilton, so we went down to Niagara Falls, about an hour away, which is like a crazy tourist trap area of Canada, as most of you probably have heard of. There's an area called Clifton Hills. It's like this, it is a tourist trap street with all kinds of like carnival games and mazes, and there's like an upside down house and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So Fox is five. So I chose this one haunted house because it had like three tiers of scariness. And I was like, okay, he can handle the lowest one, right? Because he's fully committed to like spooky, creepy stuff. And it's like all year round. It's not about, so Halloween for him is huge. It's like the thing he's been waiting for all year long. So I thought he was going to love it.
How'd he do?
We didn't even make it into the first room. Like, it was so dark. We go up the stairs and he fully freaked out. And he was like, Daddy, I want to go. I want to go. And I was like, really, buddy? You know, I turned on my flashlight on my phone and I was like trying to show him, like, you know, it's just a bunch of fake stuff. It's just like mannequins and they're all dressed up all spooky. And he was like, it was just because it was so dark and disorienting. He just wanted nothing to do with it. But I was really surprised because this is like the fourth time I've taken him to a haunted house. A couple times when he was younger, he loved it. But this one, no.
I think it makes me think of when I took Charles. Isla was like a baby. It just had her. Erin was keeping her in her arms, and I had Charles, and we went out to, you know, one of the big things, and Rob, you'll know this, like pumpkin patches are huge and like the community kids, right? Yeah, like that whole world, right? Like hyped up pumpkin patches, hay rides, yeah. Like $15 a head to get in there. Anyways, we went to one. Oh, with my sister, right? Like, she's out in the Oakville Mafia. So we go out to one and they've got a haunted house there. And my son, you know, he likes horror and, you know, we're going to get into, or not horror, he likes scary stuff. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But he went into the haunted house. There was like lights and there was hay bales all, you know, kind of surrounding, sort of looked like the entrance. The only reason he went in is because it was a big inflatable Marshall from Paw Patrol that was at the front. So he went in, right? And like, I don't know what it was. Yeah, exactly, right? So, but anyways, he kind of like, he gets scared. Like, dude, my kid, he gets scared of Corey Carson. So
only parents are going to know what you're talking about when you say Corey Carson.
Exactly.
Parents will know on Netflix that kid, that car cartoon. But yeah, so it got me thinking about Halloween. And, you know, for kids, this must seem kind of crazy. Like, Halloween lawn ornaments, like, you just, when you walk by houses these days, they're pretty gory, right? Like cut off limbs and like skulls and gravestones. Like, it's really, we're talking about little kids here because mine's 5 years, is three. Like, it's an interesting way that we teach kids about death.
You know, that's interesting, right? It's like, are we teaching them about death, or is it just really the pomp and circumstance of the, mm-hmm. of the day? You know, like, you know, Charles, he loves Halloween. He's into the costumes. He's into the decorations. He's defo into the candy. In fact, we're hitting it a week before, right?
I know.
Year, actually, you know what? This year, you know, we were really good about not getting into it. But, you know, the last couple of days, especially tonight, you know, he's into it because we're just doing this a couple of days before Halloween.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure he fully understands that the decorations are depicting like dead people's arms. Or that like ghosts are supposed to be the spirits on earth of deceased people. Although, you know, I was really close with my grandparents and Erin was really close with her grandmother. And we've kind of talked about that. I'm not sure that, you know, we've really made an explicit connection between the two. And I'm not sure, you know, he's been able to either. But,
right.
You know, on this pod, we review horror films. We do jogcasts. You know, we talk about the classic tropes, the formulas that we see in the genre, but I'm not even sure we've ever stopped to really define like what is horror, and then really what is it, and then, you know, really kind of what it is with, or horror, what horror means for children.
Yeah, that's a really good question. What is horror for children? That's actually what we're going to focus on today. Because
it's a tricky one, right? It's a tricky one.
Yeah, as a genre, and it's like a genre to itself, right? Like, I was trying to think of examples from our childhood of horror-like stuff, like that's packaged for kids. So this is a weird one. Do you ever watch the cartoon called The Inhumanoids?
Inhumanoids! Inhumanoids!
The evil that lies within. Down in the fiery depths of the earth where nightmares begin.
Like, I vaguely remember, and I didn't really remember until you showed me a few months ago, and I'm fucking scarred for life, Rob. It's the most bizarre cartoon I've ever seen. How is this for kids?
Yeah, like, I showed it to another friend. He was like, yo, it's like some TV executive thought it was a good idea to give like the heavy metal band Gwar their own TV show and like a kid's cartoon show. Like, here you go, guys. Here's a budget. Make a cartoon for us. Because it is fucking weird.
Oh, it's like, yeah, it's crazy. It's like, and in fact, I'm just rewatching the intro right now. It's insane. It's like they're made of wax and like the way the cartoon, like you're the cartoon guy, right? It's like they're morphing into each other. Their faces are melting off, which actually you can make a lot of connections between a lot of the 80s horror films and like the face melt and the green slime. Yeah. Like it kind of looks it looks the same way. Clearly, you know, it's done in a cartoon, but these monsters, they come from the middle of the planet. I think I'm just like looking hell. Now. You've got a vine guy. You've got a skeleton guy who touches people and turns them into skeleton warriors who fight for him. And this guy that looks like the devil, too.
Yeah, he basically looks like the devil. And the best part of the intro is the devil guy just throws the good guys into a volcanic lava pit. And then they font over that like the Inhumanoids. And you're like, wait, that's how the ending of the intro is? It's the good guys being thrown into a volcano, like they're dead. So if the listeners don't know the show, go on YouTube, Google it, whatever. There's a bunch of videos of people who have made like little mini docs or stories about this franchise. They've talked about the toys, the cartoon. It's pretty funny because it did get canceled, but point is, I digress. My point is that there's like a lot of media that tries to walk this line to make something scary, but still within this like acceptable range that kids should be able to watch it. This one, I don't know if they threaded that needle or not. It sounds like they didn't, but
yeah. You know. And like, who's deciding what's acceptable?
Right.
Clearly inhumanoids. We may have surpassed that line,
but they didn't get canceled by like an authority, like the government or anything. It was just, they ran out of money or they decided.
Yeah.
They
didn't sell enough action figures or whatever. There wasn't enough eyeballs or interest into it.
Yeah. And so for kids, like, you know, like Fox loves this kind of media. He's into like Lego Hidden Side. If you've ever seen that, zombies, he loves kids horror movies. And like, I thought that haunted house thing, I thought he was going to love it, but really it scared him. And he told me it was because
it looked so real and I was scared.
So how come? So TV shows are not so scary?
Yeah.
How come, you think?
Because they're just screens.
I think like most kids, Fox just likes monsters and fun, like that fun, like gross stuff, like slime. But once in a while, he talks about things that like do scare him. Like when he told me that he sees things at night.
What did you say? You have brain pictures. What's that?
Brain pictures are scary stuff that you can have. They can be good that morning and bad at night.
How can it be good in the morning? That's not scary if it's good.
It's good in the morning and bad at night.
Well, what kind of pictures do you see?
It's like, now it's just full of a skeleton cloud.
So what do you see? You see a cloud in the sky?
Yeah, but it's skeleton. It's a picture from my brain that went here, and a front of it, and it burns into my brain in a front of it. And it's scaring me in my mind.
Yeah, so you're picturing a big cloud with a skeleton face.
Not just a skeleton cloud.
Yeah, so you can always, you have the power over these pictures because they're from you. You make them.
I can only do the motion to do it. My emotion does it.
So if you're scared, you see scary stuff, and if you're happy, you see happy stuff. I see.
And he, at 5 years old, he still doesn't like to sleep alone.
I don't like sleep alone. Or just, there's like memories that show up that are scary.
You have scary, the memories that show up and they're scary?
Yeah.
Like what?
And when they come out, they're like super scary. So I get scared. And so I like someone around with me.
But they're memories. They can't hurt you, buddy. That's just your mind.
No, like a different memory. They float in the air. They're just like a picture. And not like a memory of a time.
Oh.
They're not a memory of a time. They're a memory from my brain.
Yeah, no, like same thing here. You know, my kids, especially Charles, Isla for different reasons because she's younger, but my son, like he's always wanting to get me not to sleep with him. He always says, Daddy, will you lie with me?
Yeah.
And it's comforting for them to have us there. Every parent will understand that. But it's interesting. A lot of it stems from some of like some question, not questionable, but yeah, I guess you could say questionable content we've watched. Like if we have watched something that is a little bit spooky or a little bit scary, and I'm just going to drop something in here right now. Like there's the Disney Channel Plus we have, and there's the Princess and the Frog. And the one part is where the bad guy there, right? I guess like the Cajun kind of medicine man, he descends into this kind of like witch doctor, and then there's this whole montage on the screen where everybody turns into skulls. There's lots of smoke, like a witch's brew, and that scares him. The dark content, it really bothers him, and that's when he really wants me to be there to comfort him.
Yeah, for Fox, I think it's partly comfort and partly manipulation. He just wants me to be there with him. But it's funny because he's also told me that he likes being scared.
I like getting scared, and I like the shadows in the night.
You said before, I'm just a little kid, but I like being scared.
And I like getting frightened by the shadows in the night.
Why? Doesn't that scare you?
I just like freaking up my mind. Because my mind goes back.
So is there a difference, though, between like fun scary and not fun scary?
Dark scary is like in real life. So it's like in real life, and it's not even true, so I'm never scared.
No, but is there like a bad scary?
Bad scary are dogs that are wild dogs. Those are like a wild dog and they have sharp teeth, and they're wild, and people put them in the ground, and the lobster just cuts off the chains of them, and then they go running after the person.
Like, it's interesting to see, even at a young age, that we're programmed to sort of enjoy a good scare. The way it makes us feel, like the endorphins it makes us release, it's like a little adrenaline kick for the body. I think that's why people like being scared. And I think for the kids, it's the same thing, right?
Yeah, like he kind of sees the fun in it, and he likes the tension of a good scare. But he also mentioned that his emotions can affect the scare, and you can see how nightmares and anxieties can be born from these kind of moments.
Absolutely, right? I think we mentioned in another pod, we both had nightmares watching Fright Night at a young age. Like, you know what I mean? Back to my grandparents, you know what I mean? Some shoes, a donut, and a Fright Night, and like I was hooked up. But definitely I had nightmares.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned on the Fright Night pod that, you know, Michael Jackson's Thriller scared the shit out of me. And I actually decided to show it to Fox when he was about 5, so this year. And I gave him a lot of context to try to, because I was really worried he would be scared of it. The thing that scared him the most was the Vincent Price poem and the laugh that he does at the end. And so when I first read it to him, I did that laugh, and he was like, he was scared of me for a second. And now, though, he loves it, and he kind of knows that it's coming, and he gets it, and he's waiting for it.
Yeah. Can you tell that poem? And I hide under my blanket.
This poem is called Thriller.
I know that. I like it.
You like it? But does it scare you?
I'm just going to hide under the blanket.
Do you want me to read it, or do you want to hear the guy read it? That's very scary.
I want the guy to read it.
You want to hear Vincent Price?
Vincent Price. I like the...
He's the guy who does a laugh, though, at the end that scares you.
I want you to do it at the same time.
Okay, so we'll find that. Okay, hold on.
At the end.
So as a person who went to school for media studies and who now works in TV, like, and grew up raised on a steady diet of, like, TV and comic books, I try to police Fox's media consumption, but I've noticed that he wants to watch things that are more and more intended for older kids, specifically like scary stuff.
Like, how old are we talking then? Are we talking, are we talking Beetlejuice? Are we talking The Descent? Yeah. Are we talking Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Like, what are you allowing? What are you letting slide? No,
obviously not that far. I mean, yeah, he wants to watch like things like Goosebumps, and he wants to watch like a Netflix. He saw the thing for, what's it called? Nightbooks. So he wants to watch that.
You gotta find the fine line to monitor it, right? And you gotta see how he responds, and then you also need to, like, you gotta know your kid. And then you mentioned it before, right? You have to contextualize for him, and that really speaks to the ability for like a younger child to be able to have the processing capability to understand it in context. So
the fact that he understands that difference between reality in a screen was actually really interesting to me. But, you know, for the purposes of today's pod, this all is our setup here to talk about, like, what really begs that question. Like, what is a horror film, or what is horror for a child?
Like, honestly, you know, that my son's just, he's scared of Corey Carson's Halloween, man. So for him.
Yeah. So there's like a scale of scariness we're talking about here, right? And so if you remove the blood and the guts and the, is horror just a set of tropes that follow a common story about, like, you know, it's usually like a normal situation, but some sort of representation of so-called, you know, some sort of representation of evil disrupts the natural order. And then, like, you know, it's kind of some sort of monster, and like the whole movie's about vanquishing that monster, and usually coupled with some sort of personal growth for the main character. But I mean, isn't that the same premise as like anything? Like, isn't that the same premise as like any kids' cartoon show? So, you know, that makes me wonder about the rating system, the so-called like PG, like these kind of movie rating systems. Like, what role does that play in determining like what's okay for kids?
Yeah, man. All good questions.
So I actually wanted to find an expert for today's pod. Unfortunately, I couldn't get anyone to come on, but I did get some emails out there with some interesting answers.
Not exactly selling people on the breadth of our audience. Yeah. Right? Like, you know, but we're not the experts. We're just the ones that talk. We just pretend to be right on TV, but to get some people that actually know what's going on would have been good.
Yeah, I guess not. Yeah. Our audience isn't that huge yet, but you know, we're working on it. So I'm asking myself these questions. So I started to poke around on Google, and like, lo and behold, I find an academic in the UK who literally published a book on the subject of children's horror this week. Like, it came out,
It came out this week?
Yeah, like on the 21st. So like literally 8 days ago.
Okay. She might have been busy. I know you tried to contact her.
Yeah, I did. And actually, I had a good email exchange with her. So her name is Dr. Catherine Lester. She works in the Department of Film and Creative Writing in the University of Birmingham in the UK. And her new book is called Horror Films for Children, Fear and Pleasure in American Cinema.
Okay. So what are we talking about with children's horror?
She calls it an impossible genre because it exists in these like in-between spaces between genres, audiences, and levels of taste, right? Because it's such a delicate balance. If you're too scary or violent, you can't call it a kid's movie. It's not suitable for young viewers. If it's not scary enough, it's actually not there very interesting to them. And really, that, of course, changes depending on how old they are.
Yeah, right. Because kids are scared easier when they're younger, but then they grow past it, right? They get a little bit jaded. So like a film that once scared them maybe seems silly to them as they get older. I even see that with my own son, right? You know, they have like these windows of time where like the level of horror, the level of scariness kind of fits. And then once they move past it, they need to sort of move into the next tier of mm-hmm. movies that will not even horror, just sort of stimulate them.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's just fads too, right? They grow things, and their brain over like gets it, and they want something new. But exactly, like I should also point out that in her research, she makes a distinction about, and this will kind of help frame our review today of the movie we're doing. She looks at films where the protagonist is a kid or is a child, so that the movie is being told from the viewpoint of a child. And I think that's an important distinction because
that's a good point.
Yeah, a lot of horror movies that feature kids are. Actually have adult protagonists, or or many of them are dealing with adult fears. And so this is like the movies she looks at are the ones that kind of deal with kids' fears. So that like it's kind of specific.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Actually, just off the top of my head, I was thinking of Poltergeist or Chucky, and then but then sort of looking at that way, a lot of sense. So then Fright Night might be a kid's horror, or at least like a teen's horror. What's a good example of kids' anxiety being played out in film?
Yeah, so the one I think you'll see all the time, or the common one, is like the idea of broken communication between kids and adults, right? Like we saw it in Fright Night, where nobody believes what's our main character's name again?
Charlie.
Nobody believes Charlie, right? And the whole movie, he's fighting this uphill battle to get people to believe him. So in these movies, that often takes shape as the kid knows what's going on, but the parent either doesn't believe him or is just too busy to pay attention, or just, you know, doesn't give a shit or whatever. And that broken communication manifests as like a frustration in the protagonist, and sort of trust gets eroded between kid and parent. And then, like, you know, the movie is all about restoring that by the end of the film.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's happening in Gremlins, except for the scene with the cops.
Yeah, you're right. So today we're doing Gremlins, and Dr. Lesser talks about Gremlins quite a bit in her book. One of the things she points out is that in Gremlins, every adult in this movie, and I love this, now that I think about it, it's totally true, every adult is an idiot in this movie. They're all imbeciles. The only people like capable.
Can I disagree?
Like, no, for sure you can. But I like the laundry list of dumb adults in this movie is huge. The only people like capable of affecting change or bringing like order back are Billy, Kate, and then actually Gizmo is kind of the one who really like does it. And that's the key factor in these horror movies for kids, is that they have to overcome the monster. Like they have to overcome their fear and experience that catharsis. In a lot of ways, she points out that a lot of ways these kids horror movies are like modern day fairy tales.
Oh man, that's interesting. And like anything else that you kind of glean from the emails or from learning about her?
Yeah, I read like some of her dissertation, so I can't do her whole book justice here, and I'm not going to try. But I do recommend it for any of you film nerds out there. But one of the other things that she mentions is that, and this totally interested me from like a media studies standpoint, because I did media studies for my master's, is that the marketing campaign around Gremlins was huge, and the movie marketed itself as a kid's film. And I'm not sure if you remember, Jamie, like the stuffies, the toys.
Keep him out of the light and never, never feed him after midnight.
Yes, never. It's fun to care for kids' home. He's a lovable
pet. I'll take care of you, Gizmo.
They had trading cards. They had cereal boxes.
Are you hungry? Hungry as a gremlin? Here's gremlin cereal.
Gremlins, gremlins, bite after bite. What a tasty way to satisfy a gremlin appetite.
Fast food promotions.
Cause you love Gizmo and Gizmo loves you. Now it's Gremlins that are making America say it's here, it's all here and hearty.
Video games, at least for the sequel. And like I have a Gizmo doll from my childhood, which Fox sleeps with sometimes now. And when you shake it up and down, it makes noise. I've also got, like, I love Gremlins, so I bought him a Gremlin shirt that he wears now. I bought him two Lego minifigures of Gizmo and Stripe. What else? I've got a singing Gizmo doll that my kids have beaten the shit out of now, and it just makes a horrible noise when I try to make it play now. But my point is, like, you know, I bought into this when I was a kid. I was all in on Gremlins. And the other thing is, like, you know, Gizmo, look at him. He's super marketable, right? Like, look at and also look at like how many spinoffs or people who have tried to rip him off. Like, Baby Yoda looks a lot like Gizmo, if you ask me personally, from Mandalorian. Although, you know, Yoda does pre-seed Gizmo, but they didn't have a Baby Yoda yet. But also like the Furbies. Do you remember Furbies?
I remember Furbies. Yeah.
Yeah. So those guys had to pay out like a $7 million or a seven-figure deal out to Warner Brothers because it looked too much like Gizmo. So anyways, all to say that Gremlins was pushed hard towards kids and it was rated PG.
Yeah, there's just there's some stuff in the movie that I don't know, Rob. It doesn't seem kid safe in my mind. Okay. There's some things that are questionable. In fact, we'll get into it, but there's moments in this movie that feel like totally G and that also feel totally R.
Yeah.
The movie itself actually feels very like there's almost two movies in one. And we've discussed this on a bunch of different pods we've had. But yeah, definitely there's some moments that feel really R-rated.
And you aren't the only one who thought that. Like,
okay, good.
The backlash to the horror and the dark humor and the violence in this film cast a really bad light on the executive producer, who was Steven Spielberg, who also coincidentally had another film in theaters that he had directed, known as Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And they were both catching a ton of flack. He actually called up, I guess his name is Jack Valenti. He was the head of the MPAA, and he pushed for like a tougher rating system. I think this is Spielberg's way of sort of like, you know, appeasing everybody. But he said it's got to be somewhere between a PG and an R. And so this idea of PG-13 was born, which he kind of called it PG with a little hot sauce.
Nice. So really, we can thank the PG-13 rating. We can thank Gremlins for that, right?
Yeah, apparently Gremlins and Temple of Doom are the main culprits in this one.
Nice. I got to find out how they came up with AA.
Is that Canadian only? I don't know if AA exists in the States.
Really?
I'm not sure.
Because we grew up with AA films. I guess that's like PG-13, right?
I think that's what it means.
Synonym term, right? Interchangeable. Yeah. Anyways. Temple of Doom had some nasty moments. Like that guy, there's the human sacrifice. Guy pulls his heart out. You know what I mean? I was waiting for him to take a bite out of it, right? Like straight Jason X style, right? But it's that's interesting that Spielberg is right at the heart of it, because a lot of people say E.T. is horror elements. And actually, you know, you can go back, and I was actually taking a look at this, and there's a review, a 1984 review done by Roger Ebert, talking about how Gremlins was like going to be the next E.T. or perhaps that there was maybe some connection between the two, right? Which I think can actually relate a little bit to the marketing aspect that you said, right?
100%.
You know, marketing is a horror film. I feel like more they were looking for a franchisable kind of character, right? You've got the Ewoks, you've got, the hell was E.T., you know? I had an E.T. doll.
Yeah, a lot of people
did. I loved it. And then the Ewok, you know what I mean? These stuffies, right? Anyways, but, you know, E.T. definitely has some horror elements. There's, you know, it's a little bit different, but there's some scary parts in that film.
Yeah. And he also he produced, and apparently he micromanaged the hell out of Poltergeist, which I didn't know he was involved in that. But, you know, which flirts with the idea of being a kid's horror, although it's way too terrifying. But like, point being, it's about the kid's perspective in a lot of ways. So Spielberg was definitely working on like different ways to package the horror genre, but for a younger audience.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I knew that about him, right? Like he liked the genre, you know, in his early years. But anyway, so Gremlin gets the PG-13 rating, the AA Canadian.
It never did. At least not in the States. It never got PG-13.
Oh, it never got it.
No, because it happened after it had come out. So they just left it as PG.
So you're telling me this is the first PG film that we're ever reviewing on Running Scared?
Yeah.
Oh my God, this is going to be fun. Fun EP, Rob. Got some good ideas from Dr. Lester to give us a good framework. So let's get going on the 1984 Joe Dante film, Gremlins.
All right, Jamie. So every episode we've decided we're not going to review plot. We're not going to do a point by point summary of the plot. Instead, what we try to do is summarize the whole movie in 60 seconds. This is a challenge that we give each other. Who can do it best? Who wants to go first on this one, James? You got a coin handy?
Honestly, Rob, when I think about our childhood, you were like far more a Gremlins fan than I was. So I feel like if you go first, I'm just going to be even more rattled than I already am. So let me take the first plunge.
All right. Your countdown begins in 1, 2, 3, go.
All right. The movie starts out in Chinatown with some magical realism with the young protagonist's father going through to look for a present for his son. So what he does is he finds this old shop and he looks and he's looking for something really special, and he's provided with a box with a Mogwai, and he's not sold it. But as he's leaving, the young son, or one of the somebody related to the old man who seemed to go to the shop, decides to sell it to him. So what he does is he brings this Mogwai home to his son, and this is like just a fantastic gift. The dad is like this a crazy inventor who can invent anything that works. He gives it to his son, and right off the bat, he opens it up and is fantastic. But there are three rules: that it can't get wet, you can't feed it after midnight, and it can't get light. So there's like this little cuddly creature, and essentially what happens is he takes it up to his room. He's going to take it to his teacher. He's going to show his friends Corey Feldman, who's in every fucking
and
movie.
And that's your child.
Oh my god, man! I used
you literally spent 30 seconds on the Chinatown scene.
Oh my! You know what? And I need to get better at this. At this 60 second. Listen, you're gonna find this is not easy because there's a lot
of details.
Okay. Like, what did we do last time? From Dusk Till Dawn. That's easy. There's like four scenes. Yeah. There's like four scenes in the movie. This is a little bit more. Okay, so listen, big man. Okay, right. let's put your put your money where your mouth is. Okay, here we go. Yeah. 3, 2, 1, go.
The movie begins with Peltzer. The guy's first name. He is an inventor, and he's looking for a Christmas gift for his son Billy. And he goes to Chinatown, where he discovers the Mogwai, a cute little cuddly, strange creature. We don't know where it comes from. And he sold it by the grandson because the grandfather says no, it's too much responsibility. But he gets it anyway, takes it home, gives it to Billy. And there's three rules you have to remember: you can't feed it after midnight, you can't get it wet, and it does not like bright light. Of course, Billy accidentally breaks all three of these rules. First, he gets it wet, which makes new Mogwais. These new Mogwais are more kind of mischievous. They trick Billy by cutting his clock, and they get fed after midnight. Then they turn into gremlins. Gremlins pop out of these pods. They're little reptilian monsters, and they start to destroy the town. One of them jumps into a pool, which creates thousands of them, and they destroy the whole city. Finally, of Kingston Hall, then at the end, Billy is somehow able to kill them all.
Stop.
Well, we got near the end.
Not bad. Not bad. Pretty good. We get to, you definitely got through a little bit more than I did, but there's a lot to talk about because there's like many scenes in the film, but you know what? You did pretty good, Rob. Where do we want to start with this film? I think there's a ton of stuff to cover.
Totally.
In this 1984 film. Do you want to start with the rules of the Mogwai?
I think it's a good place because it's a funny thing. It's so like linked to how horror movies work. There's usually rules. They're sort of presented. But in this movie, they're really deliberately told to you, like, these are the rules, right?
Yeah.
And they don't make any sense, really, when you think about it.
He hates bright lights. You know, there's some things I forgot to tell you guys, and they're really important. Number one, he hates bright lights. We know that. But you got to keep him out of the sunlight. Sunlight will kill him. Number two, keep him away from water. Don't give him any water to drink. And whatever you do, don't give him a bath. And probably the most important thing, don't ever feed him after midnight.
You know, I've thought about this a bunch of times. I watched the movie two or three times, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, so when they were actually conceptualizing the story and writing it out, what was the thinking behind the rules? Okay, so the first one, so there's no bright lights. Okay, so often horror films are at night. And I think that perhaps the screenwriter writing this movie, perhaps a fan of vampires, because, you know, you mean there's no bright lights. That's one of the classic gets of a vampire.
Yeah.
It's really so it the only thing that I can like think
a,
of. Right?
It ties them to a monster. Right.
It ties them. Exactly. It ties them to some kind of monster, some kind of creature that doesn't exist within normal humans. So they're clearly different, but now we know that there's some weaknesses, right? There's kind of ways to, but you know, the interesting thing is that these are not necessarily ways to harm them. These are ways to, I guess, make them turn into something monstrous, right?
To avoid which that. Yeah. The light thing is a vulnerability though. It affects both them as Mogwai or Gremlin.
Yeah. But I thought that one was kind of cool and definitely like an easy connection I could make to, you know, vampires.
Speaking of which, you're talking with the scriptwriter. You know who it is? It's Christopher Columbus who directed Home Alone.
Yeah, yeah. And so, well, there you go. So he's got some expertise with writing like probably one of the most famous kids movies ever. Kids that I still show, and you know, everybody that listens to the pod knows I teach grade 8. They love Home Alone. And the theme of destruction, I think we can weave between both those films, right?
Totally. So the second rule is no water. And this is a funny one because you're like, well, how do they drink? And it's unclear to me if they're allowed to drink. Like if it goes in their mouth, it's okay. But if it goes on their contacts, their body, it makes them multiply. And so for the Mogwai, it makes more Mogwais.
Yeah. I don't think, I think they just drink beer and that's what, yeah. That's where they get their.
And they jump in the snow, you know, and it doesn't affect them. They can drink beer. Beer doesn't work.
Like we'll get to that scene. That is the most ridiculous scene. Like they're watching a fucking Buffalo Sabres game.
I love that hockey is the sport they chose, by the way. That's so funny. Like the most chaotic, like tough sport they could think of. They threw a hockey game up there.
It was like so good. I was like, just, I was actually, when that scene came up, I was watching the game more than I was watching
the movie. I was trying to figure out the teams because it's so shitty. It's hard to tell. And I was like, hey, that's the Leafs? I think that's the Sabres.
Anyways, so they can have water, but you can feed them. So then I was thinking, okay, so, you know, you think about one of the just bare like necessities of life is water. It's like the most critical thing. And this Mogwai, clearly there's no water. It's not drinking it. You don't see them drink at all. It makes them really seem alien, right?
Yeah. Like how do they survive? It's a really good question. And it never really is answered because you see him eat like junk food, but like, you never see him eat, like drink a glass of water. So where is he getting liquid from? And that's the thing. They can't eat, but you can't feed them after midnight, which I love this rule because it's so arbitrary, like the arbitrariness of time.
No, it's not arbitrary. No, dude, this was subliminal messaging. Okay. This was subliminal messaging to the 80s youth to not eat after bedtime. And that's what like one of these rules was. Like, I firmly believe that because I was always told like, don't eat after you go to bed, don't wake up. So I feel like even a simple rule like this was somehow sort of ingraining the ideas of like youth that like you shouldn't eat after.
So you tell like little kids were told that. It's like a rule that they've been told not to break.
There's like, you know what? And that's one of the things that I'm going to point out is that, you know, we need to be critical of media in the 21st century. We teach it in class. Now you can go take a university degree in like critical media studies.
Yeah, I do have that. Keep going.
Sorry. Is that one of your master of fuck alls?
Yeah. No, that's the arts one. Yeah.
But back then everything was, you know, the median was film, right? That's when, you know, you had everybody in that collective environment in the movie theater, and then you needed to get across whatever it is you want to get across. So there's a few things that they do here. So that was one of my takeaways. I'm like, maybe they didn't think about it, but hell, that was a good message for young kids, right?
That's interesting though. I think that you're pulling that, it's like a rule that kids were told not to follow or were told to follow. And this movie's all about like these monstrous gremlins doing all the things that kids would love to do, just like fucking going haywire, right? So this idea that they can break the rules of like staying up late and then eating after midnight. I think the other thing—
Sorry, go on.
Well, just the other thing is like midnight implies this like darkness, like something happens after midnight. That's when the monsters come out. That's kind of like, it tells you about the Mogwai has this sort of dark side to him that we don't know about.
Yeah. And you know, that's funny too. Like the idea of midnight, I know with my own family around the holiday season, Christmas, like we always had to be in bed before midnight.
It's a Christmas movie.
Like it's just, like the idea of, so really when you kind of pull it away, there's all these, again, I'll just use the word kind of hidden messaging, subliminal messaging that for kids, you can see, you know, that audience they're trying to connect to without like just nothing is, it's not implicit at all, right? It's very kind of subtle. Right. It's very nuanced, but absolutely.
And so if we follow Dr. Lester's argument, the fourth rule of gremlins that nobody talks about is that all the adults are idiots. And I think this is hilarious that she pointed this out. Cause I mean, if you watch the movie, you see this, but when you start adding it up, you realize, wow, they really like, there's not a single adult in this movie. Maybe the mom who has any sort of brains. Like, so the father is an inventor, but everything he makes fails. It doesn't work. It breaks down after a couple tries. There's the Scrooge figure who's Miss Deagle, who's just
the 101 Dalmatian figure.
Yeah, who wants to kill the dog.
Yeah.
And like, then she has like 40 cats in her house when we finally learn about her life. The cops are literally drunk. Like when we meet them, they're drinking.
Isn't that a classic horror trope?
Yeah, though? And I love
the cops that are there. They can't do shit.
They're not just useless. They're drunk. Yeah, like I think they like they like amp that up a little bit here. And then, Mr. Futterman, the neighbor, the nosy neighbor, who's like Mr. Pro America and hates all things foreign. I guess he's not really an idiot, but he's just very opinionated. But he definitely comes off as like kind of a moron.
I think you got to start with the father's failed inventions. I think it's pretty clear that like the man's decision making is not top notch, right? So it's, which ties back to his purchase.
Yeah, buying the Mogwai. You know,
well, yeah, for sure.
This strange animal that can talk.
Yeah, but he decides that he's just going to purchase it and give it to his son, and he's very irresponsible. But I think that just goes to show like his personality with, you know, his inventions and maybe not thinking things too clearly or thinking things through too much. I don't know, but he never seems to me like a character that comes full circle.
No.
There never seems to be like a resolution for him. He's just there, right? He's just there making bad decisions.
And you notice one of the things about him is he's such a salesman that like when they first breed new Mogwais, the first thing he thinks of is pelts or pets.
They might even replace the dog as the family pet.
We should
he's trying to sell them, right?
He's like, well, let's go into business.
It's kind of interesting, like, the idea between East and West, American and China, like capitalism and communism. I saw a lot of that in this film, and there's a few points we'll kind of pick out later, but absolutely, like just that idea of capitalistic spirit, and you know what I mean, he wants to sell them. Like, it's just, I think we can agree, like they're being very irresponsible, Rob.
Yes.
With the situation.
Yeah.
Right?
And they're kind of assholes to the Mogwais, right? Like they do, like even Billy sort of treats them a little bit like a curiosity that needs to be, you know, explored scientifically. He takes them to the science teacher, lets them like, you know, drop more water on them than stick a needle in them. Like
Glenn Turman, man, different world. Whitley's dad.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe he's the only competent adult, but even he gets killed quickly. So it's hard to say, but anyway, the other thing I want to say about the father, though, is I think what I love, one of the things I love about Gremlins is the writing where the father makes inventions and none of them work. And if you go back to find out what the classical meaning of like where Gremlins came from, they are supposed to be this mischievous, like they're a very new invention. They come around in 1920-ish area. It's like a British aviation term. And it's like,
oh, a gremlin. It's a car, isn't it?
Well, that happens later in the 60s, 60s, 70s, 80s. I'm not sure. But the term gremlins comes from British aviation, where you would kind of pass the buck and blame like a malfunction. You'd say, it's gremlins in the rotor or whatever like that.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's good.
So gremlins by nature, they break and cause malfunctions in technology. And so then the classic story a lot of people have seen is the Twilight Zone story. It's actually William Shatner's in the episode. Like there's a gremlin on the wing of the plane. He's ripping it up and the plane has to make an emergency landing, but nobody but Shatner sees it. And so they think he's crazy, but then they look at the outside of the plane and the plane's been all ripped up because the gremlin.
That would make a lot of sense, because one of the things that comes to fruition is like the technical ability of these gremlins, right? I think I've got a laundry list of things these people can do, right? These are not people. These are reptilian, I don't know, like beings, right? But like they are, you know what I mean? Like they're tradesmen, right? They get a job in Ontario working no problem in a minute doing something, right? He's like, honestly. But anyways, but getting back to these adults or idiots. Rob, tell me, what is the point of Mrs. Deagle in this film?
Yeah, she just puts stress on Billy. That's a good point. She puts stress on Billy. She threatens his dog.
You know what? Me and you, I think I say this every podcast, like where we love an ensemble cast. Mm-hmm. And I think that there has to be something said for movies and ensemble casts where you have like the team that comes together, or you have like the bad person, the mean person, the good person, and they all come together to kind of sort of make everything happen. And I think that's what they're trying to do here with all these different characters. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure what Mrs. Deagle really has to do with the film other than trying to sell this fucking stair lift later on.
Which is hilarious how she dies. But you know, good point, because like why was Judge Reinhold in this movie? He's in two scenes and then he's gone. He never even comes back. Yeah. Like, I thought he was going to get killed. I was like, yeah, they're going to kill Judge because we hate him, right? As soon as we meet him, we hate him.
Oh, he's trying to pick up the girl. He's ordering a martini. He's talking about how much money he's going to have later on in life. And then poof, he's gone.
Yeah.
He doesn't come back to the film at all. It's like, okay, so why is he here, right?
Yeah, because you think they're setting him up to, well, Miss Deagle eventually bites it. So you assume he would get the same treatment, right? But yeah, he just doesn't come back. So definitely something was lost on the cutting room floor of this movie.
Is it like the movie was written for you to kind of feel good for the gremlins? They were just... Yeah. Giving it to the adults, like what they deserve for just being such doofuses.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the enjoyment for a kid's audience, right? To just watch all these parents get it.
Yeah. So we got the drunk cops, right? And they got the scene, they go in. So they're talking about, what happens there, Rob? He goes in to complain that there's something about to kick
Billy's
off
trying
these
to
gremlins.
Warn them that the gremlins are about to break loose because he just saw Stripe jump into the pool and he knows that they're, you know, what is it like exponentially growing and they don't last like
again.
A phone call. They have to go out and they're dead in that next scene, or at least their car flips over. So like a lot of these characters get like, even Mr. Futterman, I think he only has two scenes, right?
Yeah. He's talking about, he's got the one scene where he's talking about, see this. If this is American,
oh, the car. When he's hitting his TV in the second scene, he says to his wife, "We should have got a Zenith.
You got to watch out for the foreigners because they plant gremlins in their machinery."
Because Zenith is a North American. It's an American Zenith. Brand.
Zenith? Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I thought they were Japanese. No. I didn't even know America. Like,
this
anyways.
Is like, yeah.
But yeah,
this is probably the last standing American television was Zenith, right?
He's the Uncle Sam, right? He's the Uncle Sam for. But anyways, you got all these adults that are idiots and they don't like, do they do anything? They're just comedic relief. They're kind of funny. They just add notes to the film and you don't root. I didn't root for any of them and I didn't really feel like a strong connection.
No. And the point is that none of them are going to be the hero. None of these people are capable of being the hero, right?
Yeah. So what about the monsters like Gizmo versus the gremlins? Me and you had some interesting conversations about kind of what Gizmo is, what the gremlins are, is he resisting his own nature? Like,
I was thinking, is Gizmo like a domesticated dog? Is that kind of what he is? Like, he is like a creature that has lost his own nature, because the other Mogwais from when they're conceived immediately are little pricks. Like, they're immediately trying to get into shit. They're like reckless. They're rough. They like to trash things. We realize that they hung the dog up by the Christmas lights. Like, they don't give, like, they're little mean bastards, right?
I think we got to back it up a little more. So is Gizmo aware of himself? Meaning, is he aware of what he is and what he can be? So is he the first one? Because one of the things I sent a message to, I said, "Yo, Rob, why is Gizmo so out on the other Mogwais and then on the other gremlins, right? And then also in turn, the gremlins don't kill him.
But they do mean stuff to him.
They do mean stuff to him. They do mean stuff to him, but they don't kill him. So is he aware of what could potentially happen if one of these rules is broken? Because it doesn't seem like he's doing anything to mitigate that situation from happening. What do you think?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Like, I don't think he wants to become a gremlin. So that much I kind of think.
No, but I'm even asking, does he even know that a gremlin is possible?
You're right, because it's hard to know. Because, you know what I mean? Think there is a scene where when the gremlins have broken the clock, another example where they fuck with technology. So Billy thinks it's not midnight yet. And so he feeds them and then they're just munching away. Yeah. Like, it's like, it's really gross. You get to see their mouth and it's like all this like noises of like eating.
Like then it was chicken, right? I think.
And I think it's KFC. And and Gizmo like just passes on it, but he passes on it so like blasé, like, nah, no.
Yeah. Like, yeah. He almost rolls his eyes.
And I wonder if it's, I think that's such an intentional writing move to make Gizmo like not be adamant, because that would give it away. So Gizmo's just sort of like, nah, no thanks, I'm good.
That's one of the things that I kind of just wrestled with, and maybe something that really can't be answered. Is it like, is he the first of its kind? I guess is the one I want to know. Is he like the top of the pyramid? And then the second thing is, it would lead me to believe with the conversation that he has later on with I guess the owner, that, you know, comes with this great responsibility. Has this transformation happened before? It would lead me to believe it has. That's why he's very protective of the Mogwai, right? But that self-determination and the self-awareness and Gizmo himself sort of understanding what is actually happening. I thought that was a little bit unclear, a little bit cloudy. You've spoken about what you think, but it's just like it's something that I just keep kind of.
I think it's intentionally that they don't want you to totally know, but I get the vibe that he does know and he knows what will happen. Because I think when you see, I can't remember what scene it is, but at one of the scenes, Gizmo goes, he hears in his little Howie Mandel squeaky voice says, uh-oh, like he knows something is up. I think it's when he sees the pods. So it's kind of like it implies he understands what has happened. You know, it's hard to tell Gizmo because he doesn't like speak like full lines very often.
He's not exactly.
But there is something that differentiates him from them, and he understands what it is, and he's afraid of what they are, which is weird because this is what I mean about him resisting his nature. Like, it seems like, you know, there's definitely times in the movie where he's just like them. Like, he likes the 3D glasses. He likes movies. He likes music. He sings the Seven Dwarfs song, right? He hums it along with them when they're singing in the movie theater. He starts singing ho, hi ho, hi ho himself. So, like, you know, he enjoys the revelry that his, like, you know, his like species also takes part in, but he doesn't go all the way, and he sort of like holds back. So to me, he's like a domesticated dog who's like kind of part wolf, but doesn't really, you know, rather just live with the humans and get free meals.
It's interesting, right? The way it's kind of all set up is you feel like the Mogwai and has the transformation into the gremlin, but somehow that the Mogwai itself that's like the original form. Maybe that's not the case. Maybe the Mogwai is like the baby and the gremlin is more the adult and more the mature version of the alien. Yeah. And then the end form, like they would die as a gremlin. Yeah. Right. And so I think that's kind of
makes sense because that's how most animals that do go to some sort of cocoon stage.
That's what I was thinking, right? Like a caterpillar and a chrysalis, that sort of idea, right?
Gizmo's definitely baby-like, right? There's a lot of he's literally cradled and held by like Billy like a baby most of the time.
Well, yeah, and then would also the way it was written in the story, you know, lends a lot of connections to how the toys would be accepted and who's going to be the recipient of the stuffed toy, right? These are young kids. Mm-hmm. So that's where you can tie it into, you know, a horror film for kids. It's like it's merchandised for like 4 or 5 year olds.
Apparently,
right?
Actually, that's a really good point too, because Christopher Columbus had written it so that Gizmo becomes Stripe. And that was what the movie was really about. Sort of like Chucky, like a doll that starts off good, but then, or like deceives you as good, but then becomes evil. And it was Spielberg who said, no, make them separate. And so the movie's going to put them against each other. And in terms of marketing, how huge is that? Because now you can go to the store with your kid and the kid goes, I want the good gremlin. Guy, yeah. No, you can have the Gizmo though.
You know, which is good, but also it just opens up another marketing stream. So like you can get two depending on what your kid might like. But yeah, it's super interesting. It's a pretty brilliant concept when you think about it.
I think so. This is one of the reasons I love
like
this film.
It really is, right? And you were a much bigger Gremlins fan than I was as a kid. Like I was like straight into the slashers. You know what I mean? And Gremlins is not a movie that really is discussed a ton in like the pantheon of horror films, like on Twitter or just people that are into the... Because it's like too funny. And I think there's reasons why in the kind of the back half of the film, because I think the first part of the film is like the superior part of it, right? Before like as right up to the point of the transformation, that's like the story is like moving and it's interesting and there's things happening, right? But
let's face it. So let's get into our next section here. Let's talk about how the gremlins tear up this town and like, and let's,
oh
and
my
for
God.
Me, let's compare that to why kids would love this movie. The part about this movie that's so fun, I think, for especially little kids, is watching the gremlins just fuck up this town.
Oh my God.
So like first thing they do once they've become a horde of gremlins is Miss Deagle goes first and she goes, she thinks she's being attacked by like devils, right? Like she thinks the devil has come for her. like straight out of Scrooge, right? Like she's going to go to hell. And they like, of course, again, they fuck with technology. They've messed with her chair that she uses to go up her spiral staircase.
The chairlift, you know? Man.
And she goes flying out the window of the top floor into the streets right in front of the drunk cops who have just pulled up.
No, it's brilliant. At that point, you know, and then sort of surrounding, they have been able to hotwire a tractor. Oh, yeah. They have been able to.
That's where Futterman gets it, right? He actually comes back in the sequel somehow because they didn't show his death. He comes back in the sequel.
They rewire the chairlift. They're able to cut the phone lines. They understand which wires are the ones that they need
green light, red light.
To cut. He's able to operate a chainsaw.
That's a great scene, by the way. I love that fight.
That's a great scene. And, you know, they're smart, right? They run decoys when they're trying to like kill people and attack people. But yeah, Deagle just kind of, she needs to go. You know what I mean? She needs to get it. It's like the gremlins are enacting revenge. Yeah. And for sure, kids and parents alike, but that would be a moment where everyone's like, yeah.
That's fun. It's like, the crowd's enjoying it. Like, yeah. They want to see the gremlins do bad shit now because they're like, oh, these guys are hilarious. Let's get to the bar scene. So we talked about the hockey. This, my funniest thing I love about this is Phoebe Cates is still working the bar. Like she feels obligated to somehow continue to finish her shit.
I know. She's serving drinks. She's taking orders. She, you know what I mean? She's running orders out. She's like, she's you know what I mean? She's running a cheeseburger and fries out to table three.
She's like, I got to pay for college somehow. Fuck it.
You've got the one guy. You've got the
one. This scene is like 10 minutes long, by the way.
You've got the one guy who's the one gremlin that's had too much to drink that's fallen off the stool, and the other guy's holding him up. Then you got the card game in the back.
It's just like the painting, like the dog's playing poker.
And apparently there was a disputed hand. And he pulls out a gun and shoots him.
Yeah, that's right. Then there's that scene where like he's supposed to be like a jazz singer or something, and he gets a. I didn't understand what was happening here. There's a flasher.
It is like a ridiculous. Basically, it's like St. Elmo's Fire, the most ridiculous bar scene, and you just have That's the thing that makes it so funny is that, like, at that point, they're just, like, totally being fucking reckless, like, committing murder.
Like, yeah, like they kill each other with disregard, too.
That's the thing, which makes me think that guy has no problem killing two people at the car, like, Stripe, right? Like, he's, like,
the leader,
top dog,
yeah,
right?
He's got the mohawk.
He kills two people at the card game, but... Gizmo's not killed, which I just got to bring it back to that. I'm just wondering why he's not. He's almost like
they threw darts at him.
That's a funny scene too. He's like terrified.
Also,
they got him up on the board.
We're talking about this already.
It's like your mean brother has just multiplied into like 50 people.
I love how they use like the punk aesthetic of giving Stripe a mohawk, and that's what makes him the badass leader. And then
he's the Sid Vicious of.
And I love how beer doesn't work like water to make them multiply. Like they're just drinking beer.
Oh my god, yeah, they're all like they're hammered. It's like it's a totally ridiculous scene. It's so funny. It's hilarious. Anyways,
so Phoebe gets out of there, or Kate gets out of there, saved by Billy. Well, she makes a run for it. After she also although she does discover how the light works on them by taking photos of them. The movie theater scene. We'll fast forward a bit here. I love this scene too, where they're all watching Snow White, and like the pan of the crowd, and it is like the most packed theater you've ever seen.
Oh my god! Okay, doesn't it remind you of a Muppet scene?
Yeah, right. Absolutely, right out of the Muppets.
I'm like literally I'm watching it and I'm thinking, oh my god, this is like the Muppets.
Man, I love the Muppets as a kid. No wonder all these things are connecting now.
Yeah.
And like they're all wearing like some of them are 3D glasses. They're all eating popcorn. They're yelling. They're shouting. They're like the hardest audience you've ever had. And then they all start singing the Snow White song, the hi-ho.
You're watching Snow White. And they love
it. And that's the other thing, like talking about their intelligence. They've never seen this movie, but they have somehow picked up the lyrics and figured out how to sing along to it immediately.
Yeah, exactly. And the second half, again, is just fun. And it just descends into like this total madness, total chaos. And with those bar scene, theater scene, like in the final scene is absolutely it. And like the adults are just like, they don't know what the hell is going on. This, the town is being overrun by these characters and just, yeah, it's great.
So and then there's the final battle where, you know, Billy, Kate and Gizmo go into the, you know, the department store.
It's like the mall. Yeah,
it's a department store. They're trying to get Stripe, and Stripe is trying to make his way to the water fountain. And there's a good battle with Billy with the chainsaw, like you mentioned, because he's got a wood baseball bat. And so he's fallen down because Stripe has shot him with a baseball pitching machine, hit him with the balls. And he comes at him with the chainsaw, and Billy can only block it with his wood baseball bat, which I love because you see that he's cutting it and it's like it's about to saw apart and there's not much space left and he's trying to hold it back. So like good tension, and I'm surprisingly like kind of rough how that fight goes because he gets scratched up pretty bad. Billy gets beaten. And then the other interesting is that Mogwai, Gizmo, he's actually the one who delivers the final blow to Stripe by pulling the blinds down and, you know, turning him into the green slime melt fest that he dies into.
Yeah. Yeah. And which Fright Night, you know what I mean? From Dusk Till Dawn. I keep coming back to it. What was it about the 80s and just that special effect that seemed to make its way into every horror film?
Well, Ghostbusters comes out the same year. Oh. So again, another movie that heavily uses slime and ectoplasm and all that.
He slimed me.
For sure. But Rob, is there a dark element to this film? Like, is there actually some content that would be considered pretty questionable for young kids? Because again, this movie was, or kids were put in front of this film. This film was put in front of kids. And I think there's some pretty like crazy violent stuff that happens. What do you think about that? I mean, I'm thinking about the kitchen battle especially.
Yeah, so we've talked about the revelry of like the craziness of the film, which is why kids would love it. That's why I loved it. But there are these, you know, at least three, I would say three scenes that we've pulled out for the pod here that I think, you know, really put it up against that line of, wait a minute, was this a PG film really? The kitchen battle, which is right after the first five gremlins arrive.
Oh my.
This is like a tough fight scene. So Mom knows that the gremlins are loose. She's like, hears them in the house. She's found the pods open and they're like these gross, like, you know, I don't know how to describe them. They look like,
yeah, no, they just look like they're like cocoon pods, but they're like gray and slimy and green light, and they're all like a lot of mucus around them. Like you can tell it's something very organic.
And so she hears them in the kitchen. She goes downstairs. She sees one. And it's unclear whether or not the gremlin throws a plate at her or not, because it
just starts rifling plates.
Yeah, it just hits the wall. Anyway, she goes into battle. She puts one in the, here's the funny part, James. This is the scene where all of Peltzer's devices all work. They finally work when she needed them the most, right? The gremlin gets caught in the blender. She blends this one gremlin. She throws another one into the microwave. She sprays him in the face with the...
Okay, how dangerous was that blender?
Oh, God.
She was like making like some kind of like cake, like icing or whatever. Yeah. It's got like, I don't know, the lid wasn't on it. It was like a massive blade. The gremlin goes in there and then, she turns it on and he's like Swiss cheese.
Yeah, and then the scene that a lot of people were scared about was like she puts that one gremlin in the microwave and then microwaves him.
Oh, my
people
God,
people were scared the kids were going to start putting their pets in microwaves, right?
You heard about stuff like that, right? Like the gremlin special effects are actually pretty cool there, right? Like how the gremlin blows up in the microwave.
Yeah, it's nasty.
It's pretty like, that's pretty gruesome, pretty violent. Like,
well, yeah. And violent. The next one, she has to kill him by knifing him to death.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's enough.
Exactly. Yeah. She just has to gut him four or five times, which is like, this is where the movie's like, that's where it gets like, whoa. Like the other two, I can almost pass them on. Like, okay, the microwave was a little gruesome, but the blender, you didn't actually see him get blended. You just saw his leg sticking out. But now it's like she
the personal killer.
She has to knife this guy.
80s movies were very graphic. What was okay or deemed okay for the screen, I think would definitely be curtailed today, because some of the stuff, especially in like the action or like the cop genre, it was like very graphic. And, you know, the one thing about this film is that, like you said, you know, the microwave, you actually see him blow up, but the blender, you just see the legs, and then you just see, you see from the angle of the gremlin, and then you see the like
the knife,
the mother coming with the knife just coming down. But like, it's almost as terrifying just the look in her eye, because she's going to, she's got that look, yeah, right?
Where
she's
as a viewer, going we to are being murder. Knifed by her, right? Like that's how, so as a little kid, imagine that feeling. And it's the mom knifing you. That's the, that's what we're visualizing here, right? So exactly. For kids, that's gotta be a little rough. The other scene that this movie treads into darkness with would be, I would say, Kate's speech about her dad dying as dressed up as Santa Claus.
And me and Mom were expecting them to pull out a dead cat or a bird. And instead, they pulled out my father. He was dressed in a Santa Claus suit. He'd been climbing down the chimney on Christmas Eve, his arms loaded with presents. He was going to surprise us. He slipped and broke his neck, died instantly. And that's how I found out there was no Santa Claus.
Which, by the way, plays zero role in the plot of this film. It's like definitely just bombed in. It's funny, but not funny. Like it's dark, but funny. And the problem with it that, you know, this is what people complained about, was that for little kids, it spoiled the fact that Santa's not real. Like it spoiled the fact that Santa Claus is a figment of people's imaginations that's made up. So for a lot of parents, they were like, my kid didn't know Santa wasn't real. And now this movie just ruined it for them. And in the dialogue, she's talking about her dad dying because he got stuck in a chimney, broke his neck. So the story is that Joe Dante argued for this hard and the studio wanted to cut out, but this
scene,
Spielberg,
right?
Spielberg supported him, I guess, because he felt like...
Did they give a reason?
No, I think Dante just said it's the tone of the whole movie. The whole movie is a sarcastic joke. So this is sort of the core of that too, and it belongs in this movie. But this is what happened. People kind of was like, but my kid didn't know about Santa. So anyway, and the last thing I want to bring up in terms of this is something Dr. Lester pointed out in her book. She talks about how the ending... results in Gizmo gets put back into captivity. So like he's been let loose for a while. This thing happened because they couldn't handle the responsibility. And so in a way, Gizmo is sort of like the order is restored and Gizmo is now back into captivity. And we've seen throughout the movie that the Mogwais are kind of treated like crap, like they're treated like lab rats. And then the other thing Lester points out, and I don't know if I buy this one, but I love the thinking about this, is that she says, hey, if you watch the movie carefully, the gremlins are not the ones who shed the first blood. Like they're attacked first before they attack. And what she's referring to is that the one in the who gets taken to the science teacher, he's like treated like a lab rat. And then the one at the house, yes, a plate is thrown, but it's not clear whether he threw it at her or if he was just like throwing things because he's a gremlin.
Who threw the first plate?
And then she attacks and puts one in the blender. And so the other ones attack her. So it's a funny way to think about the movie, that maybe the humans attacked first and thereby the gremlins are only defending themselves.
Okay. I think I can buy that argument, but these are like alien beings, right? And, you know, I think history has shown that we take a fearful approach of something and anything that's different. And we want to study it and we want to learn more about it. And they absolutely, they're provoked, right? They're treated like lab rats. They're treated like lab monkeys, right? To be studied, to be tested. And like he takes him to his science teacher. And there's like, that's the one thing. Like there's no reporting of these things. These things are like, this would be like the biggest discovery in humanity, right? And he takes us to fucking Glyn Terman. you think he's a nice guy, but there's a little like glint in his eye when he's he enjoys the power that he has, and he's like, he's got him in the cage and he's like, here, little guy, just a drop of blood. Like, he's kind of enjoying that moment of being able to kind of enact his scientific, proclivities on this like poor little.
The thrill of discovery has intoxicated him, yeah. Right? Like he doesn't care about the subject enough to stop him from wanting to find out more.
And they start in captivity and they're bought and sold on the black market. Yeah, the best part is when he's with Billy and he's just in the bed, he's being treated like a pet, he's enjoying it, and Giz is enjoying it as well. He likes it, right? He likes the companionship and all that, but for sure. But
Billy does the drop of water on him just to see what happens. Like when he takes him to the science teacher, he drops the water on him to show him how it works. So, and then he leaves him with the other Mogwai. So even Billy sort of participates in that.
That's kind of crappy as well. Yeah, that's not good. Well, then you get what you deserve, right? You know what I mean? If you break rules and...
I think the movie is about how Billy comes to understand that responsibility to a certain degree. Although we never really hear him explicitly say anything, but obviously he's the one who throughout the night has been fighting the gremlins and trying to put things back to order. So of all people, he's the one who's...
Well, isn't that one of the great themes of the film, is just responsibility and not taking things for granted? And like, you know what I mean? Being respectful of things. And, you know, for me, that's a big takeaway.
Right, so that brings us to Mr. Wing. And, we can talk about the representation of the way Asians are represented in this film. But as well as the themes that Mr. Wing, brings forth in this film, this idea that these Mogwais are exotic, they're foreign, they're unknown. Mr. Wing is the only one who understands the responsibility and what can happen if they're let loose. It does speak to the sort of traditional feeling of what gremlins were. They were foreign, saboteurs of aviation, British aviation. So where that term comes from, it was always linked to sort of foreign causes of things falling apart. And then Mr. Futterman blaming all foreign technology as though gremlins come with foreign technology and thereby are not trustworthy.
Patriotic little fella, ain't he? Waving a flag and everything.
So, and I think you had some points here about how, Mr. Wing sort of represents a criticism of North American culture.
When he goes into the shop and he decides that he wants this and he's presented with the opportunity to purchase the Mogwai, he says, no, it is not for sale. It's like, I'm going to sort of exist, above that idea of the market, of that capitalistic flair,
this,
right?
Some things that are sacred, this thing should never be sold.
Exactly. The interesting thing is that when the son,
the grandson,
actually yields to the market, and that idea of the free market does two things, right? It sort of strengthens the idea that capitalism wins out in the end. And it also paints what makes this problematic is it paints the Chinese as somehow like swindlers, somehow lesser than, that they're willing to sort of go against what they believe in order to kind of make a sale and actually yield to the idea of the market. All it does is reinforce the idea that at least at that time, that American and Chinese are different, and they sort of they sort of have a different set of values that they kind of adhere to, but the son kind of comes to those American values, those American ideas of capitalism, of free market. And I thought that's something, at least for me, that's what I saw. And perhaps that's not what was trying to being portrayed.
No, I think definitely.
For me, that's a problematic, representation of Chinese people. And also, like, it's like Big Trouble in Little China. Like, why does every Chinese people have a big long mustache?
It's definitely,
some likes to be flying on a fucking carpet.
Those images are very rooted in like turn of last century. Like,
exactly. This movie was made in 1984. Like, you got to get with the times here. Like, even though at the end,
So this is the thing. Exists. At the end, he comes in and gives a speech about how, basically North American culture is based on excess and consumption, and that we don't have any sense of responsibility about nature, and we just like take.
I warned you. With Mokwai comes much responsibility. But you didn't listen. And you see what happens.
I didn't mean it.
You do with Mokwai what your society has done with all of nature's gifts.
So I hear what you're saying, although he does kind of deliver a line that sort of summarizes what the whole movie's kind of about, which is like this thinly veiled criticism of excessive consumer culture.
Yeah.
And how the gremlins are just represent like that just tearing itself apart and our reliance on it, just we fall apart with it.
Okay, but that's fine. Like I wish that he comes in and again, he sort of exists on a different or on a moral high ground as he delivers like his sermon to the people. But the problem is that you don't see him as an equal. You know, that's my issue, right? Is that you may see him as someone from the American perspective or from the non-Chinese perspective. You like just the way he's presented, sure, he may have something to say, but you don't see him as an equal with something to say. You see him as somebody different with something to say. And I'm not sure that, you know, and not in a positive way. We embrace identity, we embrace differences, but I feel like in this, it's not in a positive way, and therefore it doesn't resonate as strongly as it would if it was coming from someone who's seen as an equal. I don't think that this is like a, well, I don't want to say that's an out-and-out racist representation of Chinese people, but it's very stereotypical. It's very kind of trite, and I don't like it. It actually, when I watch stuff like this now, it really bothers me because of just how lowbrow and how just a lack of, I'm getting too heated on this, but it's just a lack of, thinking, I think, on the part of the filmmakers, right, to kind of write more interesting and more representative characters. That's all I'm saying, Rob.
You make a valid point, Jamie. And I think if you see Gremlins 2, which I don't know if you've ever seen, Gremlins 2 is like this completely over the top, completely comedy, not horror at all, ridiculous takedown of American culture. So it's really like they took it up and turned it up like a million volume points, you know, like they just cranked it. So Gremlins 2, I would love to propose to you that we do it maybe as a Patreon review, because I don't think it's strictly a horror movie, but it's
not a running scared piece.
Yeah, it definitely could be a fun one to review though. And the other thing is we've heard now officially that there is a animated series coming out for the Gremlins, which is weird that Warner Brothers sat on this franchise for almost 20 plus years without putting out anything. Like, I don't understand Warner Brothers sometimes. Like, I feel like they've kind of mishandled some of the DC superhero movies. They're sort of, and it
is that who owns DC? Is it Warner Brothers that has it all?
And then Gremlins, this franchise that has actually lived on successfully through merchandising for years, they never bothered to revisit it. There was tons of fans asking for a part three.
Yeah, like
they don't like.
Listen,
it's so confusing. Anyway, let me finish up here. Is that they're launching a prequel cartoon series? They've got two seasons because they started working on one, and then they did a quick renew of season two, which will tell the story of Mr. Wing as a child when he meets the Mogwai. So we might get this prequel that you've been asking for.
Oh, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you might get some new, some proper, better representation of Asian people within that. And then the other thing, there was a commercial that came out about 3-4 months ago from Mountain Dew featuring Billy and Gizmo. And Gizmo is trying to get some Mountain Dew. And Billy's like, you know, be careful. And of course, Gizmo spills it all over himself and he creates more Mogwais. And in this little short commercial for Mountain Dew, Billy's daughter comes into the living room with another Mogwai on her shoulder, and they see that Gizmo has screwed up again and spilt more, you know, that Gizmo's been caused to multiply again. And they both roll their eyes at him at the same time, like the jaded emo teenage daughter and the little Mogwai on her shoulder, who kind of has like a triple mohawk. He's got a weird look to him, but they both roll their eyes at him. And it's like, to me, it's like, man, you don't go that far to introduce both a daughter and a new Mogwai character unless you really are going to do a sequel. So we'll see about that. But Jamie, I think it's time we get to our review. So, Jamie, for our review, it's a little different this time because normally we just give our review. It's based on our footsteps. 5 footsteps in the Running Scared rating system means that you've made a great horror movie because you're 5 steps ahead of the killer, whereas 1 would mean you made a stinker and you're about to get murdered because you made a terrible film. This one's going to be a little different because the question we're asking ourselves off the top here was like, what is kids' horror movies? And this being an example of, you know, a kids' horror movie based on the fact that it was rated PG. Let's start with there. Is this a kids' movie?
Like for a kids' horror film to be engaged for kids, for them to be appropriate, for them to get into it. Because any kid can watch a horror film, but for kind of to be specifically, you know, for them, it's got to have, I think, some destructive elements, right? Like those Home Alone elements. I think it has to have some good music. I think that's one thing we didn't talk about, right? But I think that's one of the things with like the Nightmare Before Christmas, yeah. Tim Burton's, right? Like it's like a musical. It's like there's music throughout. Children love music. And I would have maybe wanted to see a little bit more music in the Gremlins, right? Like I think Jerry Goldsmith did the score and he wanted to incorporate a lot of like the holiday classics along with like the devious spirit. And if you listen to the score, it's like a lot of staccato stuff. So I think that's kind of one of the elements. I think you got to have.
They sing New York, New York in the sequel.
No, yeah. Do they? It's been a long time since I've seen the sequel. But the idea of being scared, being intrigued, being engaged for kids, I think there has to be like lots of action, quick transitions. I think the idea of like the animal or the monster, and gremlin, I don't know if it's a monster, but it's like it's a more kind of scary being than Mogwai. I think Gremlins really hits it for a lot of kids. I'm not going to say that this is for like kids that are age 5 and 6 and 7. It's got a PG rating. I think you could even, kids that are as young as like 8 or 9, I think maybe 10 could get down with this film. I don't know, maybe I'm more conservative.
Yeah, I would go lower personally.
Would you go lower? Okay, so you're a little bit more like, you're a little bit more progressive with that kind of stuff than I am, right? Even though I'm for my own kid, but even though I was watching stuff when I was younger. But I just think it's got a lot of the elements that kids enjoy in horror. And I think it hits on it. You know, one of the things is that I'd like to, one of the things that we didn't really talk about and we, you know, is like the psychological side.
I was just about to ask you, what is the social anxiety in this for kids that this overcomes?
Okay. So yeah, that's what I wanted to get at, is that we've talked about, and Lester, I think you're talking about like, she's like studied in like more like the film side, the literary side, right? I want to explore maybe on another pod and definitely not on this one. I want to know, and I want to talk to a psychologist, or I want to look at the actual like cognitive response or the cognitive processing of horror. And what does this film do? And how does that affect your kind of subconscious, and how do you feel about it? What's actually going on inside your body, like chemically? I think that would be pretty interesting. And I think this has it, right? I think there's a lot of like kind of scary imagery.
Well, and then the other way to look at that is like, what as a viewer do you cathartically go through in this film and in any film? So, 'cause I think like what we were talking about, kids films, it's really valuable if they feel like they can overcome the fear that they're encountering and that they are the ones who conquered it. It's not like an adult in the film solved it for them. Like the kids solved the problem. So that's the one thing in this movie I'm not totally sure about. Like in terms of
is Billy
the kid or is Gizmo the kid? Because Gizmo in a way is the kid. And did Gizmo overcome like understanding that he could become something horrible and he sort of decides to draw the line? And that's what this movie is about, is showing how he, but we don't really go through that with him. All we know is he just doesn't want to be one of them and he's scared of them and he's helping Billy stop them.
It's like, Rob, it's like a ride at an amusement park. It's like when you're a kid and you're watching something that's scary because you just lack the maturity and the ability to kind of just allow full, like a reckless abandonment. you have to be able to control it somehow. You got to feel yourself, at least at some points, being in front of, on top of the ride, riding it, mm-hmm. right? Not just always behind it, getting totally steamrolled. Yeah. Getting pulled, exactly. Yeah, that's right, exactly. Getting pulled. So I think Gremlins allows for a nice interplay between being pulled, but then actually as a kid getting in front of it, like the bar scene, because it's not scary, because it's a full panoramic shot. You're seeing the you're seeing the monsters in a totally different light, and it's not scary. So it allows a little bit like that whole tension and release idea, right? But a longer time period for kids. Anyways.
And Stripe does become murderous, which I think is the line where kids will be like, oh, like, yeah. I don't want to go that far. Like going crazy and having fun is one thing, but you know.
I watched it again three times as an adult, and I thought it was great. And I think for a kid watching it for the first time, contextualized properly at the right age, you know, it's funny. I wanted to show this to my grade eight class this year. They've never even heard of this film. And I was interested as a test case to see how they would respond. They're 12 and 13, 12 and 13 years old. So I'm not going to get a chance to, because Halloween, it'll be done.
It's a Christmas movie though. Yeah.
I'm showing Die Hard 2 at Christmas. I'm going to give this movie, honestly, I'm going to give this 4.5 footsteps. I think it's fun. I laughed my ass off when I actually go back and look at a film and study it, because like I said at the top of the pod, like this is not a film that I actually was really into as a kid. I feel like those... Yeah, you were like, and I'm glad that we waited, but I'm glad that we did it, because actually we've had a ton to say. I think those that were into maybe, I don't want to say that. No, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to give it 4.5 footsteps. I think it's great. I think it strikes the right balance for kids. I would have liked to have seen maybe a little bit more music, but again, the music is kind of stilty, a little bit staccato-y, a little bit jumpy. It's great for kids. There's great destruction scenes. There's violence, but not gratuitous violence. 4.5 footsteps from me, Rob. What do you think?
I'm super happy that you landed that high, because I thought I was kind of dragging you into this one. And it is one that's beloved for me. So I was sort of like, I wonder if this even ranks for Jamie. I thought you might go as low as like 3, because you're like, yeah, but I thought you were more of a slasher guy and you might see this as being a little bit too dumb. So I have to give this movie, like, can I give it a perfect score? I mean, is it perfect?
You can do whatever you want. This is our podcast.
I love Gremlins. Like, I love Gremlins. I think about this movie every day. I think the script is almost perfect. Like, the only thing is the Phoebe Kate scene, which I think as an adult, I actually enjoy that line about her dad dying as Santa Claus, because it's such a dark joke to just jam into this movie. But I understand the concern for parents at the time. I am on the edge of showing Fox this movie maybe next year. I'm like trying to figure out, he's 5. Maybe he has to be 6 or 7 to see it. I know my wife is not going to love to hear that. But
that's, oh my God. I can't show this to Charles. We're not even like Corey Carson's Halloween and getting like the big Kit candy bar. We're still there.
So I have a hard time finding flaws in this film, and we just analyzed it. It definitely has some 80s issues where it represents Asian people in a way that is really dated. Exoticized for the point of making them different and from another place and all that.
Yeah. Like,
yeah, I don't want to sit you off again, but point being, you know, maybe it should lose marks for that. But the other thing is, I'm really glad I found, like, I was asking myself these questions about kids' horror, and I'm really glad I found Dr. Lester's book, because it was just answering exactly what I was thinking at that time. And the fact that it came out the same week that I was trying to put this pod together is amazing. Did we shed any new light on what horror is for children? I'm not sure. I mean, I'm glad we got Fox in at the top to sort of see how he thinks about these things. Exactly, and it really makes me wonder how he's going to react to this. And I think you're right. He's going to love those scenes in the bar, in the movie theater, when they're tearing up the streets, when they're driving the tractor through Futterman's house. Like, and the fact that it makes comedy of murder or death, because they don't show it, it becomes like a little more like softer and easier to handle. And I'm wondering to myself, like, is he seeing that kind of stuff already? Like, already video games, the concept of like you die and then you come back to play again. Like, he doesn't play many games yet. I've kind of held him back from video games. He doesn't realize, he watches a lot of them on YouTube. He doesn't realize he could just play those games. He just sees people playing them. Because I haven't told him, like, by the way, I could just give you that game.
By the way, you can have a console and you can play this for the rest.
Yeah, he doesn't get that yet. But I wonder, like, how these concepts, and I'm really hesitant and I worry about a little bit about being a slave to this, to the system of like PG, PG-13, all those things. And even like you were saying, like we should get a psychologist, anyone who sort of has like a rating system, like kids should not see this kind of thing until this age. It's obviously not that rigid. It's all about how well your kid is adjusted, how well you've explained it, contextualized things for them, made them understand like what's real, what isn't. And it's like Fox kind of said, like he couldn't handle that haunted house in real life, but he can understand things are fake on a screen. And I thought that was kind of interesting and important to watching his development. So so I'm gonna land on 5 because I absolutely love this movie. Anyone can write email to me and tell me I'm wrong. I freaking love Gremlins and I'll stand behind it till the day I die. I love Gremlins too, and I'd love to do that as a Patreon thing. Those of you who haven't seen the Key and Peele skit about Gremlins 2, if you know the movie, go watch the Key and Peele skit. It is so funny because it makes you,
let's post it on Twitter. We'll get that out there.
For sure, because it is so, it totally gets how bonkers that movie is. So see that skit. And yeah, that's it for me, Jamie. This is one of my favorite films. I'm going to give it a 5, which might have an extra step in there just because of nostalgia and because my love for it that doesn't deserve, but I'm going to give it to it anyway.
That's awesome, man. You know what? That's what we got to do here. We got to do the movies that we love, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and Gremlins is, again, one that you talked about. And, you know, you talked about this for a long time. And then tying it into kids and horror, me and you've always talked about this. Rob, thanks for taking the lead on this pod and really putting it together. You know, not that I wasn't a believer, but you know, this was something that that you brought in here. Amazing. I love the conversation. And actually, you know, I would, like I said earlier, I'd like to kind of continue the conversation and maybe sort of do a little bit of an exploration in some of the other areas of kids and horror, because I think it really is interesting, especially like what age is the right age? Mm-hmm. What are the, you know, really to explore and what are the feelings that the kids get? Maybe do more interviews. What are we doing?
We're
theorizing it here, man. We're doing like, you know, we want more data. That's what we want.
Like I've let Fox watch Nightmare Before Christmas. He watched it at like 3 years old and that has
Charles just watched that. Yeah.
Like there's heads rolling around that talk, but because it's claymation, they don't really,
I was going to say, the claymation really draws it down a little bit.
And it's singing and it's fun and it's Christmas it's a great film. And we could do that one sometime. I'm not sure if it qualifies as horror, but you know, it's something we could talk about. And yeah, there's different ways we could revisit this kind of kids, horror genre discussion and get more going. And big thanks to Dr. Katz. Her name's Catherine Lester. She calls herself Dr. Katz on Twitter that I noticed. So I don't even know her that well and I shouldn't be calling her that. But anyway, big thanks to her because I did have a communication with her and she kind of helped me a little bit with this framework. Again, the name of that book is Horror Films for Children, Fear and Pleasure in American Cinema, published by Bloomsbury. And you can find that online. For those film nerds, go for that.
Awesome. Okay, Rob, listen, this has been great. What do we got going on in the next? Let's kind of wrap this up in the next 2 minutes. What do we got going on in the next couple of weeks?
We're going to do Descent.
With Running Scared. Yeah. We got Descent happening, right?
So we're going to do the Descent. You've got someone you want to talk to for that film, which would be so cool if we get an interview with this guy. I don't want to spoil it because if we don't get him, and I got someone we're trying to interview as well, it'd be really cool to put them together. Maybe not in the same room, and we'll use one as like a setup for the movie and one is about how they made the movie. Exciting to us. I think this is fun for us to, you and I talked about this, like let's not sit still on how we make these pods. We're keep trying new ways to do it. And if that involves an interview, sometimes it will.
Absolutely.
You know, we're going to keep messing with our format and keep playing until we get something we really like. But even then, I don't know if we'll ever sit still and just like make a formula. Like we're going to keep trying new things.
Yeah, man, that's not how we do things. We like to, as creative people, I think you got to try new things, right? So we'll continue to do that. We also, there's been awesome feedback on the second Jogcast series, Blood at Night. So we had the first episode out and like, what am I going to say? The feedback was bad on my own podcast? No, the feedback was really good. no, the feedback was good. Like, people enjoy it. And so we are working on the second episode. So we hope to get that recorded in the next little while. And then we should have that out to you by hopefully early November. So The Descent, another Jogcast episode. And then, you know, I think we'll kind of see where we land after that. So please, yeah, if you make...
And as well, we're trying to put out some original artwork now with our films.
I forgot to mention that.
I did my first little piece. I used to draw a lot, so I'm kind of trying to get back into it. And
It was amazing. It was so good.
Just some fun stuff to have for a little promo for us. And James, you know, the next thing we could do, James, something else we like to look forward to is Christmas. But also, we haven't done any sci-fi horror yet.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, we haven't. There was another podcast that did Event Horizon. Oh, so I love that movie.
Event Horizon.
I think we might just need to do that just so I have a reason to rewatch it. Listen, if you want to send us an email, please do at therunningscaredpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can @runningscaredpd. If you want to follow us on Instagram, you can do that @runningscaredpod. We also can be found at Patreon. You can find the link in our bio, or you can just go to Patreon, search up Running Scared if you want to help support us. That is amazing.
Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Hope you enjoyed our talk on kids horror, and we'll see you next time on Running Scared. The Running Scared podcast is produced by Robert Lendrum and Jamie Roberts, with original music by Jamie Roberts. Edited by Robert Lendrum, with original artwork by Robert Lendrum. See you next time on Running Scared. Bye.